The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and happy Thanksgiving from the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's not for a few days, but, you know.
It's close.
Yeah, we're ramping up. We're ramping up. I'd like to say we are very grateful for all of our listeners.
And our followers on Twitter and Facebook and
yes.
Anywhere else you may find us.
That is correct. That is correct. We have a good show for this week. As you may know, Tim is our resident Twitter dude. You are the Twitter dude, right?
Yes.
Okay, I get to see all kinds of interesting cryptic commentary as it filters in over the week. I don't always understand what all these little...
I don't think any of us do, but that's okay.
Okay. But a particularly interesting thread did catch my attention a few days ago. I decided it was a topic that I wanted to explore. And you still don't know.
I have no idea.
Okay. We have discussed bike share programs more than once on the show. What I didn't realize is that bike share is not the same as bike rental programs. So we have here in Cleveland a privately funded bike share program. And bike share, as it is defined, I guess, historically and classically, is not necessarily privately funded and has a different connotation and a different set of rules from what I think bike rental is. And so I decided to talk with Angie Schmidt, who is a very prolific writer for Streets Blog USA. She's going to come back on the show because she really has good commentary on anything that has to do with cycling as it pertains to transportation. And she wrote a blog about the differences between bike share and bike rental. She also had some comments on Twitter about Cleveland's program in particular. So I wanted to talk with her and get some of the definitions sort of out there and then why it's important to know the difference and what those differences really are. Then we're going to do some news. Then we're going to jump over to England. We are indeed. We are going to welcome back the executive editor of BikeBiz.com, Carlton Reed. I met Carlton at press camp in Park City, Utah a couple years ago. We've kept in touch. And at the time we met, he was telling me about his in-progress book that he was writing called Roads Are Not Built for Cars. And the book is now out. It was published and the print versions were gone in like the blink of an eye. Literally, there are no print versions available anymore in 2014. He did make a digital version and it is fascinating. It has 480 pages online. Now, I have the iPad version. And it's just amazing to me. It has the 480 pages. It has 10 short videos. It has 2 sound clips. It has 581 illustrations. And the opening instructions. So there's a how to read this book.
This sounds like a major it's Hollywood production.
It is a production. And it's really, really cool. And I don't know where he got some of his photos, illustrations. I mean, he's obviously done a ton of work on this book. And it has a great piece of opening music. Sounds a little bit like New York, New York, but it's not. It's really, really good. So I just thought that we should definitely talk with him that maybe that would be my little gift of the week idea, that if somebody's interested, again, it would have to be digital for 2014, and there should be print copies coming up in 2015. So let's head on to downtown Cleveland. because Angie Schmidt from Streets Blog USA is right here in our town. Angie, thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Just this past week, November 17th, you wrote a piece for your Streets Blog USA. It's titled The Difference Between Bike Share and Bike Rental. Earlier in the week, there was a bunch of exchange on Twitter about the Cleveland Bike Share program and how it might or not compare to others around the country. And I was kind of confused about some of the terminology. But the premise of the Twitter conversation was that our system here in Cleveland is privately funded. And so there might be some benefits for those who funded the program rather than those it was meant to help. Did I get that right?
Well, I wouldn't go quite that. I don't know if I'd go quite that far. It's what the point I was trying to make, that it's sort of important to distinguish what we have here in Cleveland now from what they have in most cities, what we generally think of as bike share. Like, actually, these Zaxter docks have never been installed at the city level anywhere else, is my understanding. And they've mostly been used sort of in corporate campuses. And in Columbus, they have them at Easton Mall. But in their city area, they have a bike share that operates a little bit differently, that's run by, I believe, Alta, which is a big company that does bike shares in cities around the country.
So explain the difference between bike share like Alta, which they tend to facilitate most of the big bike share programs, or quite a few of them,
right,
and what are small, so, sort of individually funded, or should I say independently funded? You're really calling that bike rental.
Yeah, well, a Dallas blogger was making the point, they have a system a little bit like this set up there, and he made the point that it really operates a lot more like bike rental than true bike share. And he made the point for a number of reasons, and I think he made a really good point. So in New York City, where they have 6,000 bikes on the streets, and the idea is that you take a bike, you check it out from your location, you ride it to your destination, and you return it there. So the system is really set up to serve transportation cycling. And the fee system is structured in a way so that it discourages long trips. So the idea is you're going to take one trip on this bike. It's going to be a trip that maybe doesn't happen in a car. It's going to reduce congestion. It's going to be better for the environment. You'll get a little exercise, and you have a new option about how to get around. So if those systems are about changing the way people get around cities, and New York is the best example in the whole country, but it can have a big impact on mode share, on, you know, the percentage of people that are getting around on bikes. So I was talking with the director, or the policy director at New York DOT yesterday, and he said they now have 35,000 to 40,000 city bike trips in their central business district a day.
Wow.
Right.
That's a huge number.
Right. They're really committed to, he was trying to make a distinction between cities that are just installing bike share to say they have bike share, and cities that are really committed to changing the way people get around. And in New York, really committed, I mean, that the director of policy, he's from an advocacy organization. They've been very progressive there, and they're really moving the needle on how people get around there. What we've got here is really a lot different. The fees are structured differently, like you pay $3 an hour or $24 for 24 hours. So it's really set up to serve more of a recreational purpose, although you could technically use it for transportation. It's just not, because there's so few docks here in Cleveland, it wouldn't be very convenient to use for transportation, probably. And since they were installed, I don't think I have seen anyone using one of the bikes. Normally, like in Columbus, they have a very small bike sharing system, but it is, you know, more what you'd consider traditional bike share as opposed to bike rental. And they have a strong branding for their system. They always have strong branding. In Columbus, it's called Kogo Bike Share. And the bikes all have a similar look, and they stand out from other bikes. And so you would recognize, hey, there's a Kogo bike. Or if you're in D.C., Capital Bike Share, oh, there's a Cabby bike in every city. There are different colors. They have different names. But in Cleveland, we haven't really done that. We've sort of taken a shortcut. And some of us are a little bit concerned about what might be the repercussions.
So here in Cleveland, we don't have as many bikes. We don't have as many stations. It was not set up as a citywide transportation alternative. It was set up by a group of, as I remember, it started with a group of breweries, actually, for the most part. And so it's like ride your bike from from bar to bar, almost. But the pricing structure, if you're saying $3 an hour, $24 a day, the way the pricing structure works for true bike share, the way, say, D.C. does it or New York does it or Chicago does it, it's really more of a you join the bike share as a member.
Right.
Okay, so are bike sharing programs meant as profitable programs? Are they trying to actually make money on them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm glad you brought that up. Now, some people have made the point that because our system is intended to be profitable, and we'll sort of see if it is able to, and what we mean by profitable is an operating profit. So it wouldn't have to be subsidized after the initial investment of installing the bikes just to keep sort of operating. And most cities around the country, their bike share systems aren't profitable, but they don't need to be. Our bus system isn't profitable on its own. It's subsidized.
Right.
Our sidewalks are subsidized. You know, people have to get around, and there's a public good to getting people from place to place. It supports our economy. It supports quality of life. So, and because of the way transportation systems function generally as a society, we, you know, all contribute a little to systems that work for everyone. So I don't think we should hold bikes to a double standard where they need to be profitable, but alternatives, you know, are worthy of subsidies. So I think that's sort of a mistake to have that mentality, especially because bike share systems have so many positive externalities, so many benefits for society. You know, we have a big obesity problem in our country, and that's very expensive. So if we can shift a fair amount of trips from driving to biking, then we can reduce that problem and society is better off. So that's one reason a lot of cities think it's a good idea to subsidize biking. It also, you know, it reduces congestion on the streets and it improves air quality. So most cities think, you know, it's worthwhile if they need a little bit of subsidy. And often they really don't need very much subsidy. I mean, they're actually a lot more self-sustaining than other forms of transportation by and large. Washington, D.C.'s bike share almost turned an operating profit one of the first years it opened. So it almost broke even, which is pretty incredible for a transportation system.
I'm speaking with Angie Schmidt. She is with Streets Blog USA. We're talking about bike share as opposed to bike rental. And one of the questions that came up, or one of the comments that came up in the conversation I was sort of following on this Twitter feed, was about how the bike system, the bike share or rental system here in Cleveland, might just peter out, that it may not be something that is sustainable. And you would think that if it was privately funded, it would be more sustainable. But from what the conversation I'm hearing from you is that the ones that are more universally transportation and are more sustainable because government is involved, perhaps, or nonprofit is involved.
Yeah. I'm not really sure which would be more sustainable, but I think it's sort of, we're comparing sort of apples to oranges. Because what we have is not very comprehensive. It's very limited. what I'm really more concerned about is not that this system will peter out. It's more that because people have been sort of confused, people think we have bike share. We have people think, well, we have maybe a system that's similar to what they have in Columbus or Cincinnati. But I think what we have is different and a little bit inferior. But there is a plan. The city of Cleveland and a bunch of community partners went through a planning process to do a real bike share. And I think they said the plan, they found out it was feasible. They hired consultants. They did a study. And they said, yes, Cleveland can support 80 or more docks. Those would have at least 10 bikes. I think they said 600 to 1,200 bikes potentially the city could support. So we have a plan that says we can do, you know, a large scale, real public utility style of bike share. But sort of before we got really moving with that, some private individuals launched this private system. And my concern is,
the city will look at it and say, well, we have bike rental. We have bike share. We don't
need
this big system. Right.
The whole community will think that other plan isn't a priority, won't understand the difference between the two, and will lose out on what could be actually the kind of thing that would really move the needle on biking and would really make our city more sustainable and healthier and more active.
Okay, now I understand where some of the comments came from about this sort of rogue plan that came into being on a short-term basis. Will it be sustainable on a long-term basis? They're probably not going to expand the one that we have now.
They have a little bit. Actually, they are expanding it
a little bit. Oh, okay.
Yeah, which is part of a little bit of what concerns me because the partners, they're expanding it out of Ohio City to Detroit, Sherway, and Tremont, which, you know, well, obviously will make it more useful and isn't a bad thing in and of itself, but the partners were nonprofit groups like Detroit Sherway Community Development Organization and Tremont West, and with some help from Enterprise. So now some of these nonprofit groups are contributing resources to the system, and there's nothing wrong with that in itself, but we also need resources to move forward on the larger plan.
Hopefully these resources won't be squandered, you know, on a short-term plan as opposed to the bigger picture.
Yeah, I wish, honestly, I wish that the folks who had come up with the Zagster idea, I think it would have, if they could have put that effort into the larger bike share system, I think we may have been well on our way. Now, their opinion was that, you know, the city was sort of dragging its heels and that maybe it would be a long process and they didn't want to wait for that. There's nothing inherently bad about having these bikes. I mean, it is nice that you can rent a bike in a few locations around Cleveland, but the only concern some of us have is we'll miss out on sort of a larger opportunity potentially if we shift focus away from that and put aside sort of the larger plan.
The last question I want to ask you is about a larger plan. Your column about vacancies at the federal level in transportation posts and a comment you made that was, quote, it is one of those rare opportunities where the Obama administration could dramatically support transit, bikes, and livability goals. That is a much larger picture. And I'm wondering what you think that opportunity might be should the administration begin to fill some of those vacancies.
Yeah. Well, the head of the Federal Transit Administration is being served by an acting administrator right now, and so is the Federal Highway Administration. Those are some powerful posts in transportation. And President Obama has preached, at least, a really pretty progressive agenda. He's a pretty progressive leader on transportation. So he could, if he chose a new head of the Federal Highway Administration, for example, that was a real smart growth advocate and really understood the importance of complete streets, you know, that could help sort of shift the organization's focus to be a little more sustainable, a little more bike friendly.
Would those appointments have to be vetted through Congress?
Yeah, I believe so. They would. And
okay. That kind of answers part of the question right there, because things just don't seem, you know, he might appoint somebody and that person may never have the opportunity to actually serve.
Yeah, I don't know if they're high enough level appointments, though, that they would become a big political grudge match. But who knows? You know, who knows? But it certainly wouldn't hurt to try.
Exactly. What are you working on right now?
Oh, we just finished up a three-part series about the Indiana Toll Road that went bankrupt in September. It's a $3.8 billion project. And it's sort of interesting because there's a lot of private funds flowing into the toll roads right now, and it talks about whether or not those are going to be good, viable, long-term investments. And it's an investigative story. It's kind of interesting. It could be a little bit shady, maybe.
Well, I enjoy reading your column. It's Streets Blog USA, Angie Schmidt. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we will check back and see what some of your new ideas are on cycling. I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
All righty.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Angie Schmidt joined me from her home in Cleveland. I think she lives on the near west side.
It's interesting, and it's always good to have somebody who's got the pulse on really what's going on. And, you know, from the outside, we see programs pop up and we think, hey, that's a great idea, without realizing other things that could be going on in the background and
right.
how that might affect it. A couple tag-ons to this. We reported last week or the week before about Tampa and their new program that they just started. And I know Coast is the company that has the bike share program. The average trip is 14 minutes. And then on Thursday, on The Sound of Ideas, I heard an interview with someone that they were talking about transportation across the United States and how they're looking to incorporate rail and buses and bikes. So you go from point A to point B, and then from B to C, you ride a bike, and then you move on. And it's good to see that we have national discussion about all of this and actually some planning towards all of it instead of little bits and pieces all over.
You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to take some time for some news right now, and that kind of just feeds right into our news.
One of the things that we did talk about, and with The Sound of Ideas, they're talking about in Cleveland.
So people know The Sound of Ideas is our morning NPR program here in Cleveland.
Thank you. We kind of get stuck, you know, assuming that everyone
knows that, right?
But the keynote speaker, and this is on Monday night, if you have any interest, Cleveland Connects, which NPR calls their community conversation, is a forum that's in a public location that you can discuss all of these wonderful things. And the keynote speaker is Beth Osborne, the Vice President of Transportation and Development Services, Transportation for America. So here's a perfect tag, a perfect tie-in to everything that we're going to do. And actually, if you just go to the IdeaStream webpage, you can get all the information from there.
So it's WCPN.org. I think you click on IdeaStream.
Yep. You'll find it right from there. They're actually going to have somebody who's the Director of City Planning from Cleveland, Mike McIntyre, the moderator for The Sound of Ideas, will moderate the show. And there are other things. And cycling fits into the plan of everything that we see long term.
Well, hopefully that's going on in a lot of places. There is a new campaign from our friends at People for Bike. Now, every week, I guess we're going to have to mention Rebecca Rush, right?
Yes, of course.
Since we interviewed her. Well, also our friend Chef Bijou Thomas. This new campaign, and we've seen other similar campaigns, so it dresses them up in their other clothes, other than their kit. So Chef Bijou, of course, is wearing his chef's outfit. And for those who didn't realize it, Rebecca Rush is wearing her fireman's outfit. And she's really like all decked out in firefighting stuff. And there are maybe 7 or 8 different people. Tim Johnson is decked out in the other work that he does, which I can't remember off the top of my head. But It is a really nice campaign. I don't know where these ads are going to appear, but they certainly are on peopleforbikes.org if you want to see these cool ads. And I hope you start seeing them in your community. That would be nice.
They have lots of different pictures of lots of ordinary people and extraordinary people also.
Extraordinary people. There you go.
Another Astana positive. It's been announced that Viktor Okishev failed a drug test for steroids. And they found this positive at the Asian Games. That makes a total of four off of that team. And I think you said it best when you said, well, who hasn't tested positive?
We should just test for who. Yeah.
Let's just go from there.
So this comes from Velo News. And somebody sort of floated the idea that the Grand Tours should be shortened. And the director of the Giro d'Italia went, oh, no, they shouldn't. It's a Velo News article from Milan. Giro d'Italia race director Mauro Vegni said the idea of shorter Grand Tours would be stupid and that it is not part of the UCI's proposed reforms. We did not talk about it. We talked about reform in general, Vegni told Velo News of the Paris meeting among cycling stakeholders last week. I've never seen a real proposal on the table to reduce them. It would seem stupid to me. We have a good thing. Why cut it back? UCI President Brian Cookson, however, responded to rumors that the body could shorten the three Grand Tours, the Giro d'Italia, the Tour de France, and the Vuelta a España, to ease the strain on cycling's calendar. Nothing is untouchable, Cookson told Spain's AS newspaper Wednesday. We want to plan for a better sport in which the top cyclists are able to participate in the top races. With the current calendar of three Grand Tours each 3 weeks, it's impossible. So, along with that, when it was posted, my friend Alexi Graywall, who is a retired cyclist, had a different idea about the 3 weeks of the Grand Tours and suggested that the Grand Tours should remain 3 weeks, but they should be on a rotating system so that only two are run each year. And you fill the hiatus year with a woman's two-week length tour. Run once every year, once in France, once in Spain, once in Italy. The Tour of California and Colorado might consider doing the same thing, be run every other year and lengthened to a full 2 weeks, eventually spanning three weekends. That would make the value of the races higher, the season more manageable for the riders, and more profitable for all. I thought that was an interesting idea.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Disgraced former cyclist Lance Armstrong made an inauspicious debut in a new sport when he attempted the beer mile this month. Armstrong, 43, suffered a hiccup when he tried to qualify for the inaugural Flow Beer Mile World Championships in his hometown of Austin, Texas. The beer mile, which originated in the U.S. in 1980s, gee, there's a shock, requires competitors to drink a full can of beer before each of four laps of 400 meters on a running track. However, after successfully downing his first can, Armstrong managed just one lap before dropping out of a qualifying event on November 8th. Armstrong admitted, that was not what I expected.
Who would have thunk he was a short hitter on the beer front?
We're okay as long as he's...
Right. That is funny. All right. And I'll bet I know what your last one is.
We don't like to talk politics a lot. We don't...
Well, we're not endorsing anybody.
We stay away from this.
But this is pretty cool.
Here's the headline. New gubernatorial candidate touts BS detector.
That's a good...
Frankfort, Kentucky. Following a primary defeat in this year's congressional elections, Democrat Jeff Young says he'll run for the governor's office in 2015 and bring his BS detector. Young, a retired engineer and employee of what is now the Kentucky Department of Energy, Development, and Independence, announced Monday he'll kick off his campaign from the state capitol on Tuesday. He pledged in a press release to defend the economic well-being and personal liberties of Kentuckians. Young, who lives in Lexington, also announced that, here it is.
Here it comes.
Cherokee Shill will join him on the ticket running for lieutenant governor.
Is that unbelievable?
So some people have a little bit of adversity and they go away. They do something completely different. Or they move towns. They do something else. Cherokee goes from being arrested, being ticketed, having all of these issues, to running for lieutenant governor.
I think on that note, we're going to take a break. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be back right after this.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And we are going to head over the pond, as they say, and talk with the managing editor, executive editor of BikeBiz.com about his book, Roads Were Not Made for Cars, Carlton Reed. Carlton, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. How are you?
Diana, I'm fine, and thank you for inviting me back.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Back in April 2013, you launched what became a fully funded Kickstarter project for your book, Roads Were Not Made for Cars.
Yes.
The print version is already sold out?
I printed 1,000 softbacks and 100 hardbacks. And the hardbacks went in 6 hours, and the softbacks took a bit longer, but it was about a week to 10 days, and they were all gone too. Never hit any shops. It was all just purely from the website. So it was sweet.
It was just amazing to me because, of course, I didn't end up with a print version of any sort, but you did graciously give me a code so that I could get the electronic version. It's really great. I mean, it's awesome. It's an extravaganza. There are 10 videos, 2 sound clips, 581 illustrations, and not to mention some of the really good music at the beginning. How did you pick that particular music, piece of music?
I had the sheet music for a while. I found it in a library. And at the time, I had a guy called Greg Johnston, who was the piano teacher of my kids. And I just showed him that and said, can you record that for me? And so he went away and he does what musical people, I'm not musical, he does what musical people do. And he gave me an MP3 and then I loaded it into the book. So that's how it got there.
Well, I do want to talk about some of the technical aspects of the book a little bit later in our conversation. But begin with the backstory and when you began researching the book and how you came up with the topic, Roads Were Not Built for Cars.
I can quite genuinely say the title came to me on my bike. So, you know, it's like an Einstein moment. I was riding along and I believe I was cut up in some way by a motorist, I believe, just thought he had priority because he was in a very heavy, fast motor vehicle, and we're going through this same kind of space, and I had, what would I, if I was in a car, I would have had priority, and he just wanted to come on through. And it was like the hierarchy is like, I've got a car, so I'm clearly more important than you, you're on a bicycle. So it was one of those kind of moments which we all experience when we're out there on our bicycles. And I just went from a historical point of view, but you know, roads were even built for cars. And it's like, oh, okay, that's what I'll call my book, because I had an idea.
It's a journalistic moment.
it really was, just came into my head, because I've been researching the history of roads. I had the kernel of a book in my head, and I think my original title was Love Asphalt, because it was going to be the history of asphalt and how cyclists, you know, were responsible for getting asphalt put down. That was the basic of it. So I actually registered a website, and it was loveasphalt.org, loveasphalt.com, all this kind of stuff. And that was the working title. And then this debacle happened on the road. This new title was given to me by this particular motorist. And that's where it came from, Dan.
Well, let's thank him after the fact, just for the moment, even though he was obviously trying to take over your space.
It's a polemical title, and I do recognize, you know, Love Asphalt is a quite a weak title, and the one I then chose is an in-your-face title. It's obviously something that can actually get people's backs up. Because, you know, on social media, when you start saying, you know, roads are not built for cars, it makes people very, very angry. But the book, if I don't know, you may have read some parts of it, it really isn't an anti-motoring book at all.
No, it's not at all.
An awful lot of people who haven't read the book assume it is, and assume that I'm saying, you know, roads were built built for bicycles. And it's not what the book's about at all. It's very much an academic history, but with a light touch. And the book's foreword is written by the president of the Automobile Association, and the equivalent for you would be the AAA. So the president of the AAA in America is the kind of the guy who's written the foreword for the book. He wouldn't have written a foreword if it's an anti-motoring book. He just thought it was an eye-opening book on roads history. And he was fascinated by how closely related cycling and motoring were. And he's quite famous in the UK for saying, you know, we're not two tribes. You know, motorists and cyclists are the same people. And this was a history book that basically fleshed out that concept, in that cycling and motoring were once absolutely joined at the hip, and it was never a, you know, all cyclists are hateful to motorists and vice versa. It was the same people. So motoring was actually founded by cyclists, which is kind of ironic.
That's paralleled throughout the whole book. Just, you know, as you move through the book, it's obvious how the two are always somehow connected. But so what time period does the book cover? It actually covers way back at the beginning of when roads actually were being thought of to be used by bicycles, before cars, and even carts of some sort, yes?
Well, even mastodons. I mean, that's roughly where it starts.
Oh, that's pretty old.
Yeah. So, the route between Detroit and Washington was actually padded out by mastodons. That's, you know, there's archaeological evidence for that. So, the roads were not built for cars. They were actually built by extinct megafauna. Yeah, exactly. So it kind of starts right back with transhumans. So with animals padding out the first trails. So the history, kind of, there's a timeline that goes right the way back, but really, quite genuinely, it pretty much starts 1870s. So when the first bicycles come along, because that's how roads originally got improved quickly, when these pushy, white, middle-class, elitist guys, mostly guys, on bicycles in both the UK and in America, started pushing for road, because what we've got to remember is roads were, when railways came in, roads were very much thought of as to be not part of any future. You know, they were neglected, and everybody assumed that the future would always be on rail, and then maybe in the air. But road transport was thought to be just something that was never going to come back. So two generations went by where nobody looked after the roads, nobody improved the roads, nobody spent any money on the roads. And then cyclists came along, and cyclists, like motorists that came after them, and as they actually developed motoring, they realized that it was absolutely essential to have good, smooth roads to use these newfangled machines. So cyclists were the first to push for what became the good roads movement. And that was a movement that was later taken over by the motoring organizations, who said they founded it.
Yeah,
so
of course.
There was a famous advert in the 1920s with the Ford Motor Company saying the Ford started the movement for good roads. And it's all complete historical hogwash. You know, it was the cyclists who created the good roads movement. And it was, in effect, the cyclists that pushed to get things like the 1916 Highways Act in the US, which eventually, after a few more years and a few more acts, you know, paved the way for the modern US highway system.
Literally and figuratively. I'm speaking with Carlton Reed. He is over in England, and we're talking about his new book. Well, it's actually been out a little while. Roads were not built for cars. There are no more print copies of it. It is available digitally, and we'll let you know how you can get a copy of it at the end of our conversation. You actually went into research about surface. Tell us a little bit about all this stuff that actually became the stuff of road surface.
Yeah, well, cyclists were very keen on the latest advances. So their machines at the time were at the cutting edge of industrial design. You know, we a lot of people now think of bicycles as some, you know, archaic throwback. But in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and probably stopping at about 1905-ish, then bicycles were very much at the cutting edge of transportation and of engineering. And so these people on the cutting edge forms of transport were the, absolutely the key and ideal people to also want cutting edge surfaces for their riding. So they were the staunchest evangelizers of asphalt, originally of just crushed stone, so macadam. You know, cyclists were perfectly happy riding on really good, well-graded, well-compacted macadam, you know, crushed stone. They were quite happy on most streets were made of wood in most certainly most English big cities, and in quite a few American cities, the streets were paved with wood. So cyclists were quite happy with that. But when asphalt took about 40 years, it seems like a kind of a boring topic to delve into, but it took 40 years to get the perfect recipe for asphalt. You know, it wasn't an overnight thing. And cyclists played a role in perfecting that recipe.
Is asphalt today the same as what they perfected then? So have there been any changes in the makeup of asphalt?
Absolutely. I mean, it's much more complex than you think. It's not a simple thing. It has, you know, AASHTO is the American Asphalt Standards and the recipe for it. So that was improved massively after cycling. So in the 1920s and 1930s, the recipe got even better. And we now found, you know, the perfect asphalt that we now see everywhere. So the first asphalt, for instance, that was put down on Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C., and that was a much more natural product. So from a lot of them was from the Trinidad Lakes, asphalt lakes, and that was put down. And it was kind of viscous. You kind of would put your shoes into it, and it would like take your feet down into it like a porridge, and then it would kind of come back out again. It was quite a strange material. Cyclists loved it because it was very smooth, but in bad weather it did kind of crumble, and so that was eventually taken up, and then other asphalt treatments were put down, and they were eventually taken up, and then, you know, cyclists were pushing for this all the time, and they were the people in local ward levels, in local districts, were trying to get each district, for instance, in San Francisco, a lot of the roads that were covered with asphalt. The people who were pushing for this most heavily in the late 1890s were the cyclists, and there was parades down Folsom Street in San Francisco, led by the cyclists, because they were the ones who put the asphalt or ask the city to put the asphalt down, because cyclists in the 1890s were a political force to be reckoned with, a massively influential lobby, because they were rich, they were elitist. You know, we now have this impression of cyclists as being lower class. Well, that absolutely wasn't the case in the 1890s. So if a bunch of pushy cyclists said they wanted asphalt on the roads, then politicians had to react to that, because they were the people that could make or break them. So in Chicago, the mayor was voted in on a cycling ticket, and he absolutely relied on the votes of the cyclists. He wouldn't have got in if it hadn't been for him promising good roads.
Well, that takes me to another part of the book that talks about, you're talking about this sort of white elite cyclist. There was a lot of prejudice against anyone who wasn't white riding a bike. And probably the person who most exemplifies that was Major Taylor, and how he was not allowed. Was it the Zigzag Club? Something like that.
Of Indianapolis, yes.
Yes, in Indianapolis, yes. And so you actually go into some of that, that the LA LAW at the time, which is the League of American Wheelmen, which today is the League of American Bicyclists. Before a certain period of time, I think 1999, they actually issued a resolution that righted a wrong, as we see it in terms of, prejudice and bigotry from the early 20th century.
Yeah, 1890s when it was some of the southern chapters of the League of American Wheelmen pushed through this openly racist bar on black members. And so I do touch on that. It really isn't a major part of the book, but I do touch upon it. And, you know, I don't really cover racing in the book apart from just mentioning it where it's appropriate to mention it in the story. So Major Taylor maybe gets a couple of lines just because the particular club that he was in opposition to another Indianapolis club, which was the Indianapolis Bicycle Club that later went on to the people in it founded the Motor Speedway there. And you know, the whole motor racing circuit sprang out of this particular bicycle club. So that was the only reason of mentioning Major Taylor, really.
Well, I just thought it was interesting that we're looking at the people who were influential politically, who now we're looking at and saying that perhaps they're not as influential. I mean, we're trying to get more cycling friendly laws and bikeways and all that. And it's just interesting how it sort of turned itself on its head, and it is no longer the cyclist who has the kind of power that the motorist does.
It doesn't, but there are absolutely clear parallels between, I mean, you're an outlier here, Diane, because you're a woman, but most certainly advocates of cycling tend to be white, male, middle class. And no matter how much we try and escape that, if we look at the demographics that we just see looking back at us, for me in the mirror, and for a lot of people if you go to meetings, then that will be the demographic there is. And that is the parallel with the 1890s, is white, male, middle class. And one of the hopes of more infrastructure is that then would expand the demographic, so more women would get into cycling, more children would get into cycling. So that's clearly the hope of more provision for cyclists as we expand the gene pool.
Let's talk a little bit about the roads are for cars attitude, because you do delve into it quite deeply. And there is, right at the beginning of the book, you quote a Daniel Mears of the Gold Coast Bulletin in Australia saying, "Roads were invented for cars. Roads are for cars, not bikes," end quote. And it is a misconception that a lot of people have, I am sure, in Britain, as they do here in the U.S. I mean, people riding on the road are told all the time, get off the road. This you don't pay taxes is one of the big comments that we get. So how do you think that idea became so ingrained in public opinion?
It is a redneck thing, partly. So the people who will shout at you to get off the road, almost certainly it's a redneck kind of attitude to have. But even, you know, inverted commas, normal people would also have that belief. And it's Darwinian in some respects. So it's, you know, I have the bigger, faster vehicle, so you shouldn't be on the road. In the book, I don't say this is an anti-cyclist thing, because it's also the fact that lots of pedestrians are chucked off the roads. I talk about the Amish people in Pennsylvania are also chucked off the roads in their buggies, and that that you're slower than a motor car, so you shouldn't be on the road. So it's kind of it is bullying. In that, you know, the bigger, faster vehicle takes precedence, and that's just a Darwinian view of who should be on the roads. Apart from the fact that, you know, these megaton trucks, well, should they actually take precedence because they're bigger than cars? Well, maybe car drivers wouldn't think that. But using your weight and bulk, I'm assuming even the biggest of SUVs have got to get the hell out of the way of a 25-ton truck. So it is a dog eat dog thing out there. So there's just it comes down to bullying your way through the public highway.
It is still always amazing to me that when I'm behind the wheel of a car, I have a very clear perception of what a cyclist needs on the road. But there is no education at a level that children, when they're learning to drive, understand the difference between riding a bike and driving a car. Once they get that driver's license, you know, it's a whole different attitude. So I also thought it was interesting that as far back as the 30s, and you have so many beautiful graphics in this book, I don't know where you found all this stuff, but it's really, really cool stuff, that cyclists were being injured and killed by motorists. And you have a set of pictorials, and one is a mother's putting a sign on her son that says, "Please, Mr. Motorist, watch out for me." And another, it shows a modern-day website. It's a big stop sign, and it says stop. And it's, I guess it's a dash, smidzy.org from the British Cycling Group, CTC, which is, sorry, mate, I didn't see you. What is that?
Yeah. That's just kind of an acronym that's used if there's an accident, and that's another word in inverted commas, if there's a road incident. Well, often a motorist will say, "I didn't see the cyclist."
Right.
And in vernacular, that becomes, and you genuinely, people do say this, "Sorry, mate, I didn't see you." And it's like, well, no matter how much high vis you put on, no matter how many flashing LEDs you've got, no matter what you do, an awful lot of motorists, sadly, and I think it is a choice thing, they choose not to see cyclists. And it's not just because they didn't physically see the cyclist. It's the cyclist doesn't register on their brains when it hits their retinas. It's, oh, there's a cyclist. They're doing 2 miles an hour. Of course I can pull out. Smash. You know, when they shouldn't have pulled out, when they should have stopped. And if it was one of those 25-ton trucks I've been talking about, I don't know how much these actually weigh, but let's just say 25-ton, then they would stop. And it's not just because that truck is bigger so they can see it better. It's also because that truck can kill them. So they then take care not to pull out in front of a truck. A bicyclist coming along is not going to kill them. So they tune them out. They tune cyclists out. And if you ride on the roads lots, you will see that ever so frequently. And if you are lucky enough to be in a smash, then one of the things you will hear motorists saying is, I didn't see you.
I know, it's one of those. So if you'd seen me, would you have hit me anyway? You know, yeah, I think it's one of the stupidest things people say.
But no, that is absolutely the question you've got to ask. And it's like, you know, I think someone would say, yeah. Yeah, that's quite frightening, yeah.
Really? So you don't live in London.
No.
But London has a very cycling-friendly mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Boris, I think his name is, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. Yep.
Do you think that his attitude is changing anything over there? Are things changing in England, or are they pretty much staying the same?
It's one of those difficult things. And until you get tons of these bike paths put in, it's hard to see anything happening. But just looking at the plans that are going in, if they come to fruition, if the plans aren't watered down, and an awful lot of vested interests are trying to water down those plans, but an awful lot of white, elitist, middle-class, pushy cyclists are trying to stop that watering down of the plans. So bicycle advocates are being very, very cool and clever at trying to protect what Boris is trying to do. But if the plans do come to fruition, there are some remarkable bike paths going to go in. Rome wasn't built in a day. You know, it's going to take an awful long time for these fantastic networks to become grids and to become something that everybody can use. But you've got to start somewhere. And if nothing else, I mean, my favorite one is the one that's going to go past Parliament. So that just says, you know, it puts down a marker, both literally and figuratively, and it just says we are now catering for cyclists. And to do that, we've taken a lane away from motorists. Because at the end of the day, that's what's got to happen. We've got to have roads where some space has got to be taken away from motorists. It certainly can't be taken away from pedestrians because you want people to walk as well. So it's got to come from somewhere, and it's going to have to come from what some people call car lanes, but in fact I just rode. So the road space has got to be shared more equitably, and one of the ways of doing that is with infrastructure.
So are you going to have any reprints of your book? Are you considering taking it back to press?
Oh yeah, yeah.
No,
in the new year. Well, the iPad version, that's actually been updated twice already. So I've put new pictures in, and I had like 600 photographs in there and illustrations.
Wow.
So that does get, because Macs are quite clever and iTunes is quite clever, I can update that and everybody gets pinged and they can download the latest version. Kindles aren't so good at doing that. So Amazon isn't so hot on sending out updates when you do stuff. So I've been a bit tardy on doing the updates on the Kindle version. But the print version will be a revised second edition. So it'll be, I haven't actually found, people haven't told me that many mistakes. I've been really surprised. I thought it'd be ripped to shreds by, you know, the expert cycle historians out there. And quite the opposite. I think I've had one date which is different. So instead of 1877 should be 1878. As far as I can tell, that's the only historical error I've made.
Well, you know, we should just take you to task for that, Carlton. I mean, really. Come on.
Well,
really?
The best cycle historian pretty much in the world has reviewed the book, and he said he could find nothing. So it's like, wow, I really have done my research here.
Well, I really appreciate you talking with me about it. It would make a very nice gift. Tell our listeners how they could get a digital copy now and then maybe the printed copy when you reprint it in the new year.
All the same place, really. So roadswerenotbuiltforcars.com. When there are print versions available, just a little box will flash up and saying that they're back and available. I'll probably make it available in other places as well, but all the links will always be on roadswerenotbuiltforcars.com, and certainly the digital stuff is, you know, direct linkage from there.
Well, I appreciate you talking with me. I hope you have a wonderful holiday, and we'll talk again.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Diane. Have a nice evening.
You too.
Bye-bye. Carlton Reed spoke with me from his home in England.
Well, there's nothing that's ever new again. We talked about 100 and some years ago, rail was the future. And we got away from rail and got into cars, and we're right back to looking at transportation options, getting rid of the cars, more rail so we can open up the roadways, more cycling. It's the same thing again.
Well, on that note, we are done for tonight. This has been a great interview with Carlton Reed. He is also the editor of bikebiz.com, which is a very active and busy website in the UK. I appreciate him taking time to talk with me today. I want to wish everybody, and Tim wants to wish everybody, a very happy Thanksgiving. I hope you'll not eat too much. And if you have an opportunity, remember, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.